This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test, Summer 2019. This test is in four parts and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1, Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about their hobbies. Read the list of hobbies below, then listen to the extracts. For each question, 1 to 5, identify the hobby by marking a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all hobbies are given, and each hobby may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Speaker 1.
After a busy day, sitting down with a book might be the last thing anyone wants to do. However, setting aside a regular time and making it part of your daily routine with a book has its benefits. A good novel can serve as an escape into a different and exciting world, or non-fiction can be a means to learn something new about a topic of interest.
Speaker 2.
Some people may not like spending time in the kitchen, but others thrive on experimenting with different ingredients and trying to produce the perfect dish, which not only looks good, but tastes good. There is a sense of achievement when you can surprise your friends and family with something new and delicious which you have made.
Speaker 3.
Getting out and about is one of the best things you can do for your body. You don't need to go to the gym. Instead, think of exploring a local park. Or you can go out into the countryside. All you need are a pair of good boots, comfortable clothes, and a map if you are going further afield. It is a great activity to do with friends and family.
Speaker 4. It may appear a solitary hobby, but there are many enthusiasts and there is the chance to meet and to admire other people's collections. One of the great things about this hobby is that you can learn a lot about many countries. You can build up your own collection by swapping with or buying from others specialising in topics such as famous people, memorable sporting moments, fauna and flora, or relating to a particular country you are interested in. Speaker 5.
There is no need to spend a fortune on a special camera. You can have brilliant results using the camera app on your mobile phone. It is always on hand, ready in your pocket, and it is easy to use. Just click whatever catches your eye. Do not be afraid to take as many pictures as you like while you get more confident. You can always delete the unsuccessful ones.
Now listen a second time and check your answers. Speaker 1.
After a busy day, sitting down with a book might be the last thing anyone wants to do. However, setting aside a regular time and making it part of your daily routine with a book has its benefits. A good novel can serve as an escape into a different and exciting world, or non-fiction can be a means to learn something new about a topic of interest.
Speaker 2.
Some people may not like spending time in the kitchen, but others thrive on experimenting with different ingredients and trying to produce the perfect dish, which not only looks good, but tastes good. There is a sense of achievement when you can surprise your friends and family with something new and delicious which you have made.
Speaker 3.
Getting out and about is one of the best things you can do for your body. You don't need to go to the gym. Instead, think of exploring a local park. Or you can go out into the countryside. All you need are a pair of good boots, comfortable clothes, and a map if you are going further afield. It is a great activity to do with friends and family.
Speaker 4. It may appear a solitary hobby, but there are many enthusiasts, and there is the chance to meet and to admire other people's collections. One of the great things about this hobby is that you can learn a lot about many countries. You can build up your own collection by swapping with or buying from others specialising in topics such as famous people, memorable sporting moments, fauna and flora, or relating to a particular country you are interested in. Speaker 5.
There is no need to spend a fortune on a special camera. You can have brilliant results using the camera app on your mobile phone. It is always on hand, ready in your pocket, and it is easy to use. Just click whatever catches your eye. Do not be afraid to take as many pictures as you like while you get more confident. You can always delete the unsuccessful ones.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear a person talking about how to trace your family heritage. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Recently, there have been a number of television programmes in which celebrities find out about their ancestors. Some of the stories told were sad, others amusing, but all fascinating and sometimes quite surprising. Tracing your own family is not that hard to do, nor is it very expensive, once you have taken some basic steps. Firstly, it is important that you start with yourself by writing your own biography and work backwards, remembering to include anything you can remember about your immediate relatives. Try getting as much information as possible from your family, remembering to look at letters and photos, both of which can hold valuable clues. Some families even have a family journal in which marriages, births and deaths have been recorded. Once you have got as much information as possible, you can start looking at the extended family. The internet is very valuable and widely available to help in your search. Many of the sources are free of charge, and these include census records of births, deaths, marriages, occupations and professions. If your family have not travelled far but spent most of their lives in the same locality, it is possible to visit some of these locations. Perhaps see the school they once attended, or capture images of graves, memorials, and take note of inscriptions on them. There might even be someone who remembers a family member and can provide anecdotes. There are also parish records and newspaper records. Tracing your ancestry is something that once you have started becomes a very addictive hobby, and you might want to learn more about where your family first came from. DNA testing is now relatively inexpensive, and it is the most accurate means of tracing your roots and gleaning some valuable and possibly even surprising information.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Recently, there have been a number of television programmes in which celebrities find out about their ancestors. Some of the stories told were sad, others amusing, but all fascinating and sometimes quite surprising. Tracing your own family is not that hard to do, nor is it very expensive once you have taken some basic steps. Firstly, it is important that you start with yourself by writing your own biography and work backwards, remembering to include anything you can remember about your immediate relatives. Try getting as much information as possible from your family, remembering to look at letters and photos, both of which can hold valuable clues. Some families even have a family journal in which marriages, births and deaths have been recorded. Once you have got as much information as possible, you can start looking at the extended family. The internet is very valuable and widely available to help in your search. Many of the sources are free of charge, and these include census records of births, deaths, marriages, occupations and professions. If your family have not travelled far, but spent most of their lives in the same locality, it is possible to visit some of these locations. Perhaps see the school they once attended, or capture images of graves, memorials, and take note of inscriptions on them. There might even be someone who remembers a family member and can provide anecdotes. There are also parish records and newspaper records. Tracing your ancestry is something that once you have started becomes a very addictive hobby, and you might want to learn more about where your family first came from. DNA testing is now relatively inexpensive, and it is the most accurate means of tracing your roots and gleaning some valuable and possibly even surprising information.
That's the end of Part 1, Section B. Now turn to Part 2. Part 2. In this part, you will hear a careers officer giving advice to teenagers on interviews. For questions 11 to 18, listen and then complete the notes. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
An interview is a discussion in person, by phone or online, between you and an employer. The employer wants to see if you're the right person for the job. You'll get the chance to make a good impression and talk to the employer about what you have to offer. You can also see if the job is the one you want. Think about which areas of your application form or CV the interviewer might ask you about and how you can relate them to the job. Prepare some answers about why you want the job, what your strengths are, and any relevant experience you may have had. If this is your first interview, consider some of your hobbies and interests outside school or college. You could think of some questions to ask about the job and the company at the end of the interview. Only don't ask about pay yet. Try to relax the night before, as doing lots of last-minute work could make you more anxious and reduce your sleep time. On the morning of your interview, check that your clothes are clean, smart, and comfortable, and don't wear too much perfume or aftershave. Having checked the venue in advance, make sure you give yourself plenty of time to get there. Even aim to arrive a little early, so that you have time to collect your thoughts. Make sure your mobile phone is turned off. Look alert and attentive. Make sure you speak clearly and confidently. Don't use slang, and do give full answers. Don't just say yes or no. Make sure you fully understand the questions you're asked, and don't be afraid to ask for more explanation if you need it. Take your time when thinking of your answer. If you are asked about a certain experience, remember the STAR technique. Talk about the situation you were in, the task in front of you, the action you took, and the result of your action. Don't lie or exaggerate, as the interviewer may see through you, and even if you get the job, your employer can dismiss you if they find out you have been dishonest. If you are asked about a work skill you do not have, admit it, but be positive and explain that you are willing to learn and that you are a fast learner. Be confident, but not arrogant. And don't assume that just because you have got as far as the interview stage, you've got the job. Employers don't like disrespectful or overconfident candidates. If the employer contacts you after the interview and offers you the job, thank them and agree things like the start date and what to bring with you on the first day. If you weren't successful, ask for feedback on your performance and use their comments to improve for the next time. You might have, in the meantime, changed your mind about the job which you originally applied for. If you decide you don't want to take it, apologise and thank the employer for their time. You do not have to explain your decision, but remember to be courteous, as you may want to work for them in the future.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
An interview is a discussion in person, by phone or online, between you and an employer. The employer wants to see if you're the right person for the job. You'll get the chance to make a good impression and talk to the employer about what you have to offer. You can also see if the job is the one you want. Think about which areas of your application form or CV the interviewer might ask you about and how you can relate them to the job. Prepare some answers about why you want the job, what your strengths are, and any relevant experience you may have had. If this is your first interview, consider some of your hobbies and interests outside school or college. You could think of some questions to ask about the job and the company at the end of the interview. Only don't ask about pay yet. Try to relax the night before, as doing lots of last-minute work could make you more anxious and reduce your sleep time. On the morning of your interview, check that your clothes are clean, smart, and comfortable, and don't wear too much perfume or aftershave. Having checked the venue in advance, make sure you give yourself plenty of time to get there. Even aim to arrive a little early, so that you have time to collect your thoughts. Make sure your mobile phone is turned off. Look alert and attentive. Make sure you speak clearly and confidently. Don't use slang and do give full answers. Don't just say yes or no. Make sure you fully understand the questions you're asked and don't be afraid to ask for more explanation if you need it. Take your time when thinking of your answer. If you are asked about a certain experience, remember the STAR technique. Talk about the situation you were in, the task in front of you, the action you took, and the result of your action. Don't lie or exaggerate, as the interviewer may see through you, and even if you get the job, your employer can dismiss you if they find out you have been dishonest. If you are asked about a work skill you do not have, admit it, but be positive and explain that you are willing to learn and that you are a fast learner. Be confident, but not arrogant, and don't assume that just because you have got as far as the interview stage, you've got the job. Employers don't like disrespectful or overconfident candidates. If the employer contacts you after the interview and offers you the job, thank them and agree things like the start date and what to bring with you on the first day. If you weren't successful, ask for feedback on your performance and use their comments to improve for the next time. You might have, in the meantime, changed your mind about the job which you originally applied for. If you decide you don't want to take it, apologise and thank the employer for their time. You do not have to explain your decision, but remember to be courteous, as you may want to work for them in the future.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear a radio interview with a well-known television presenter. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Welcome to Book Club, our monthly radio magazine. To coincide with the publication of his latest book, An Incredible Life, it's my great pleasure to introduce someone who's worked tirelessly in the field of wildlife conservation and who could only be called a household name or national treasure. Welcome, Sir David.
I'm not sure I like the term national treasure, or even being a household name. Both are used so often they become meaningless. It's true that I've been broadcasting for many years, and I find it extraordinary that people who started watching me when they were young are now in their 70s or older. And if their letters are anything to go by, they still enjoy my programmes.
You can't deny that you are loved, not just nationally, but globally as well. Yet the world of broadcasting is fickle. So how can you explain your enduring popularity?
Well, the programmes I present are not very controversial, because people love looking at the natural world, and I just happen to be associated with that.
Bearing in mind that your interests lie in the natural world and its conservation, it's rather unusual that your childhood was rather urban, wasn't it?
Yes. I was born in London and then lived in Leicester in the Midlands. Whenever I could get out on my bicycle into the countryside, I would explore and observe nature. There were times I didn't have to go far. We had so many different butterflies in our garden back then. Sadly, this is not the case now.
From butterflies to big cats is a long jump. So what got you interested in wildlife conservation?
When I was 10 years old, I attended a talk by a world-famous conservationist who was fighting to save Canadian beavers from extinction. His message that the actions of people were endangering wildlife has stayed with me ever since.
Your programmes have changed a lot over the years, haven't they? I remember in your earliest programmes, you invited zookeepers from London Zoo to bring animals into the studio to talk about them.
Yes, that's true. But I wanted to produce a new type of programme that filmed animals in the wild. Zoos had become less popular as people didn't like the idea that wild animals were caught and kept in small enclosures. Today, zoos are different places altogether and take part in education and conservation of endangered species.
So tell us a bit about your groundbreaking programme, Life on Earth. I remember when I first saw it. It was so different from anything we had seen before. What was the idea behind it?
Most natural history programmes looked at the lives of animals, showing where they lived, where they found their food, and how they raised their young. I wanted to look at how animals evolved. We started to look at fish, birds, and mammals, and how they adapted to their environment.
You must have had, over the years, some unique experiences, ones which you'll never forget. What would you say were your most amazing moments?
Without a doubt, my most memorable encounter was with a family group of gorillas in the rainforest in Central Africa. During the day, the adults would sit in the forest resting and eating leaves and stems while the youngsters would play. One group I was with allowed me to sit with them. One gorilla even sat in my lap while another held my head and had an interesting time examining my hair.
A lovely story. You've encountered and handled various species. Is there any animal that you don't like or possibly are even afraid of?
I've handled deadly spiders, snakes, and scorpions without batting an eyelid. But if I see an ordinary rat, I'll be the first to run. I have to work hard to prevent myself from jumping on the table and screaming.
All your life, you've been a tireless campaigner for conservation. You strongly feel that education in schools plays an important part in protecting our planet. Why is that?
From an early age, children must be taught and made aware of the unsustainable growth of cities, agriculture, and fishing. We are not only damaging the animals around us, but also harming ourselves.
Over your lifetime, thanks to the television programmes you've produced, you've helped to increase dramatically our knowledge of the natural world.
Well, you also have my fantastic film crews to thank for much of what you see on television. Although cameras are increasingly sophisticated, the person behind the camera must be prepared to wait hours, even days, to capture the right moment. I just supply the commentary.
A few years ago, at 84 years old, you were the oldest person to go to the North Pole. Have you given any thoughts to retiring?
As long as I'm offered work, which I feel I'm capable of doing well, I hope to carry on. As soon as I realise that I'm running out of ideas of what to say and what type of programmes to produce, I know it will be time to go.
Thank you, Sir David. May you inspire and educate us for many more years to come.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Welcome to Book Club, our monthly radio magazine. To coincide with the publication of his latest book, An Incredible Life, it's my great pleasure to introduce someone who's worked tirelessly in the field of wildlife conservation and who could only be called a household name or national treasure. Welcome, Sir David.
I'm not sure I like the term national treasure, or even being a household name. Both are used so often they become meaningless. It's true that I've been broadcasting for many years, and I find it extraordinary that people who started watching me when they were young are now in their 70s or older. And if their letters are anything to go by, they still enjoy my programmes.
You can't deny that you are loved, not just nationally, but globally as well. Yet the world of broadcasting is fickle. So how can you explain your enduring popularity?
Well, the programmes I present are not very controversial because people love looking at the natural world, and I just happen to be associated with that.
Bearing in mind that your interests lie in the natural world and its conservation, it's rather unusual that your childhood was rather urban, wasn't it?
Yes. I was born in London and then lived in Leicester in the Midlands. Whenever I could get out on my bicycle into the countryside, I would explore and observe nature. There were times I didn't have to go far. We had so many different butterflies in our garden back then. Sadly, this is not the case now.
From butterflies to big cats is a long jump. So what got you interested in wildlife conservation?
When I was 10 years old, I attended a talk by a world-famous conservationist who was fighting to save Canadian beavers from extinction. His message that the actions of people were endangering wildlife has stayed with me ever since.
Your programmes have changed a lot over the years, haven't they? I remember in your earliest programmes, you invited zookeepers from London Zoo to bring animals into the studio to talk about them.
Yes, that's true. But I wanted to produce a new type of programme that filmed animals in the wild. Zoos had become less popular as people didn't like the idea that wild animals were caught and kept in small enclosures. Today, zoos are different places altogether and take part in education and conservation of endangered species.
So tell us a bit about your groundbreaking programme, Life on Earth. I remember when I first saw it. It was so different from anything we had seen before. What was the idea behind it?
Most natural history programmes looked at the lives of animals, showing where they lived, where they found their food, and how they raised their young. I wanted to look at how animals evolved. We started to look at fish, birds and mammals and how they adapted to their environment.
You must have had, over the years, some unique experiences, ones which you'll never forget. What would you say were your most amazing moments?
Without a doubt, my most memorable encounter was with a family group of gorillas in the rainforest in Central Africa. During the day, the adults would sit in the forest resting and eating leaves and stems while the youngsters would play. One group I was with allowed me to sit with them. One gorilla even sat in my lap while another held my head and had an interesting time examining my hair.
A lovely story. You've encountered and handled various species. Is there any animal that you don't like or possibly are even afraid of?
I've handled deadly spiders, snakes, and scorpions without batting an eyelid. But if I see an ordinary rat, I'll be the first to run. I have to work hard to prevent myself from jumping on the table and screaming.
All your life, you've been a tireless campaigner for conservation. You strongly feel that education in schools plays an important part in protecting our planet. Why is that?
From an early age, children must be taught and made aware of the unsustainable growth of cities, agriculture, and fishing. We are not only damaging the animals around us, but also harming ourselves.
Over your lifetime, thanks to the television programmes you've produced, you've helped to increase dramatically our knowledge of the natural world.
Well, you also have my fantastic film crews to thank for much of what you see on television. Although cameras are increasingly sophisticated, the person behind the camera must be prepared to wait hours, even days, to capture the right moment. I just supply the commentary.
A few years ago, at 84 years old, you were the oldest person to go to the North Pole. Have you given any thoughts to retiring?
As long as I'm offered work, which I feel I'm capable of doing well, I hope to carry on. As soon as I realise that I'm running out of ideas of what to say and what type of programmes to produce, I know it will be time to go.
Thank you, Sir David. May you inspire and educate us for many more years to come.
That's the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4. In this part, you will hear an extract from a radio programme about the history of weather forecasting. For questions 31 to 32 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. For questions 33 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Welcome to Science World. As part of our series, The World Around Us, we shall be looking at the development of weather forecasting. Each morning, millions of us turn on our radios and televisions for the weather forecast. Do cloudy skies mean rain? Will the early sunshine last? Will rising temperatures bring a thaw to melt the ice and snow? With us in the studio is Professor Smith, who will try to dispel some of the myths about meteorology or the science of weather forecasting.
Thank you. I will start with a definition of the term weather forecasting. Weather forecasting is an attempt by meteorologists to predict the state of the atmosphere at some future point and the expected weather conditions. Knowing what the weather will be like can be of enormous importance to individuals and organisations. Accurate forecasts can tell a farmer the best time to plant or harvest, an airport control tower what information to send to planes that are landing or taking off, ships at sea when a storm or a hurricane might strike. The expression weather forecast was coined in the 19th century when the first predictions or forecasts were being tentatively made. The art of forecasting began with early civilizations using recurring astronomical and meteorological events to help them monitor seasonal changes and to try to understand the phenomena of weather changes. Throughout the centuries, attempts have been made to produce forecasts based on weather lore and personal observations. As late as the 19th century, fishermen, farmers, and others who worked in the open had to rely on what could be called weather wisdom. In other words, the appearance of clouds and animal behaviour were considered good indicators of bad weather conditions. Even as late as the 19th century, many still believed that weather patterns were totally chaotic. Nevertheless, important theoretical advances had been made over the centuries. The 18th century saw a greater understanding of how storms functioned. Scientists produced weather charts, which made it easier to visualise storms and air movement. By the middle of the 19th century, scientists were able to predict where and when a storm might strike. After a series of maritime disasters, national storm warning services were set up to send storm warnings to ships either at sea or in harbour. The Meteorological Office came into existence. One of the major problems at that time was that weather warnings were localised. Admittedly, there were hundreds of small weather stations, but communication between them tended to be patchy and inefficient. It became clear that scientifically based weather forecasting on a broader scale could not be possible until meteorologists were able to collect data about current weather conditions from a wide range of weather observation stations. They would have to organise the data quickly and then ensure that this vital information could be transmitted almost instantaneously. It was the invention of the electric telegraph that made this possible. This revolutionary new technology was invented in 1837 and, according to a popular newspaper of the time, far outstripped the swiftest tempest in speed. The telegraph was the mainstay of communication between weather stations until well into the 20th century. The first weather maps as we know them today were published round about the same time. You could say that the age of scientific forecasting had begun. The more data meteorologists acquired, the more they became aware of the enormous complexity of the weather. New graphic devices were developed so that weather maps could show this additional information, like wind direction and force, along with lines that show where warm and cold air masses meet. Nowadays, we have hundreds of weather stations around the world, cooperating with each other and using very sophisticated equipment to track and monitor weather conditions. An enormous leap forward was about 50 years ago, when the first weather satellite was launched into the Earth's orbit, equipped with TV cameras to monitor air movement. Today, satellites orbit the Earth from pole to pole, beaming down pictures of the weather which they view from space. Not only do they take pictures, but also measure temperature, humidity, and the speed with which air is moving. This data is then transformed into weather forecasts by calculations made by meteorologists with the aid of sophisticated computers. Are we any nearer to 100% accurate weather forecasting? 50 years ago, weather forecasting was an art based on interpreting data from a mixture of sources: observation stations, planes, balloons, and as a result was not always accurate. Today, much is improved thanks to satellites and sophisticated computer models. As for a foolproof system of weather forecasting, I cannot say. The Earth is a living organism and as such can present us with surprises when we least expect them. The Earth's weather systems are enormously complicated and it is not possible to take all the measurements needed to make a 100% accurate forecast. And scientists still do not understand all the forces that shape our weather. Nevertheless, modern weather forecasting is accurate enough to be taken seriously.
Thank you, Professor, for an informative lecture. In other words, the next time the forecaster tells you that rain is likely, you'll probably want to grab your umbrella as you go out.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Welcome to Science World. As part of our series, The World Around Us, we shall be looking at the development of weather forecasting. Each morning, millions of us turn on our radios and televisions for the weather forecast. Do cloudy skies mean rain? Will the early sunshine last? Will rising temperatures bring a thaw to melt the ice and snow? With us in the studio is Professor Smith, who will try to dispel some of the myths about meteorology or the science of weather forecasting.
Thank you. I will start with a definition of the term weather forecasting. Weather forecasting is an attempt by meteorologists to predict the state of the atmosphere at some future point and the expected weather conditions. Knowing what the weather will be like can be of enormous importance to individuals and organisations. Accurate forecasts can tell a farmer the best time to plant or harvest, an airport control tower what information to send to planes that are landing or taking off, ships at sea when a storm or a hurricane might strike. The expression weather forecast was coined in the 19th century when the first predictions, or forecasts, were being tentatively made. The art of forecasting began with early civilizations using recurring astronomical and meteorological events to help them monitor seasonal changes and to try to understand the phenomena of weather changes. Throughout the centuries, attempts have been made to produce forecasts based on weather lore and personal observations. As late as the 19th century, fishermen, farmers, and others who worked in the open had to rely on what could be called weather wisdom. In other words, the appearance of clouds and animal behaviour were considered good indicators of bad weather conditions. Even as late as the 19th century, many still believed that weather patterns were totally chaotic. Nevertheless, important theoretical advances had been made over the centuries. The 18th century saw a greater understanding of how storms functioned. Scientists produced weather charts, which made it easier to visualise storms and air movement. By the middle of the 19th century, scientists were able to predict where and when a storm might strike. After a series of maritime disasters, National storm warning services were set up to send storm warnings to ships either at sea or in harbour. The Meteorological Office came into existence. One of the major problems at that time was that weather warnings were localised. Admittedly, there were hundreds of small weather stations, but communication between them tended to be patchy and inefficient. It became clear that scientifically based weather forecasting on a broader scale could not be possible until meteorologists were able to collect data about current weather conditions from a wide range of weather observation stations. They would have to organise the data quickly and then ensure that this vital information could be transmitted almost instantaneously. It was the invention of the electric telegraph that made this possible. This revolutionary new technology was invented in 1837 and, according to a popular newspaper of the time, far outstripped the swiftest tempest in speed. The telegraph, was the mainstay of communication between weather stations until well into the 20th century. The first weather maps as we know them today were published round about the same time. You could say that the age of scientific forecasting had begun. The more data meteorologists acquired, the more they became aware of the enormous complexity of the weather. New graphic devices were developed so that weather maps could show this additional information, like wind direction and force, along with lines that show where warm and cold air masses meet. Nowadays, we have hundreds of weather stations around the world, cooperating with each other and using very sophisticated equipment to track and monitor weather conditions. An enormous leap forward was about 50 years ago, when the first weather satellite was launched into the Earth's orbit, equipped with TV cameras to monitor air movement. Today, satellites orbit the Earth from pole to pole, beaming down pictures of the weather which they view from space. Not only do they take pictures, but also measure temperature, humidity, and the speed with which air is moving. This data is then transformed into weather forecasts by calculations made by meteorologists with the aid of sophisticated computers. Are we any nearer to 100% accurate weather forecasting? 50 years ago, weather forecasting was an art based on interpreting data from a mixture of sources: observation stations, planes, balloons, and as a result was not always accurate. Today, much has improved thanks to satellites and sophisticated computer models. As for a foolproof system of weather forecasting, I cannot say. The Earth is a living organism and as such can present us with surprises when we least expect them. The Earth's weather systems are enormously complicated, and it is not possible to take all the measurements needed to make a 100% accurate forecast. And scientists still do not understand all the forces that shape our weather. Nevertheless, modern weather forecasting is accurate enough to be taken seriously.
Thank you, Professor, for an informative lecture. In other words, the next time the forecaster tells you that rain is likely, you'll probably want to grab your umbrella as you go out.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you and good luck.